Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything. Feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so I don't fight.
Exactly as I predicted. At 9:05 Pacific time, Mike Etor joins us. And Mike, first of all, how are things in Florida? Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mac. Everything is good here. Can you hear me okay?
I read you Lima Charlie. Over.
All right. Good to go. Yeah, no, it's 78 degrees. I'm sitting here in PT gear and ready to go.
All right, let's just tell everybody what you're doing now. Mike, we'll talk about Mike's career in a second, but right now you run Fidelis Leadership. Tell everybody what the company you put together, what you guys do.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to explain that. I run the Fidelis Leadership Group, and essentially I teach and coach leadership, mostly to senior executives and their leadership teams, and I teach a model that I've actually trademarked it. I call it trust-based leadership. And it is largely based off of Marine Corps leadership as I was able to adapt and apply it in the business world. So that's what I do. I teach leadership. It's the best job in the world. I actually almost feel guilty about charging people for it. But I love it. Bottom line is I help develop world-class leaders, and I love it.
Well, I have to correct you, though. You have the second best job in the world because I will tell you this. Going around doing this thing I call post-traumatic winning, which I, too, have trademarked, and changing the lives of people that have been affected by trauma is clearly the best job in the world. So we could fight about that at a different time, but that's I will tell you, I think you would agree with me in saying this. I mean, there's no greater feeling than knowing that you change somebody for the better and they see it a different way and they're on to doing great things and ultimately great things for other people too, which I think makes sense to all of us. So we could fight that out at a different time.
No, totally agree. I'm on board with that. I agree entirely.
All right, let's talk about your career. You've been on the program before. The most interesting thing about Mike is his dad's relationship to the Picatinny Rail and the Picatinny Arsenal. So with that aside, take us through your career in about 2 minutes. Born and raised in New Jersey, yes?
Yeah, I was born in New York State, Schenectady, New York, which is the object of ridicule my entire Marine Corps career where I had to list my date of birth. Who the hell ever heard of Schenectady? So I caught a lot of crap for that. But yeah, I lived there. My father worked for the government and weaponry and arsenals. And he got transferred to Picatinny Arsenal when I was 10 years old. And so, yes, I largely grew up into adulthood in New Jersey. Enlisted in the Marine Corps at age 17. I graduated on the 12th of June, 1974 from high school. And on the 17th of June, I was en route to Parris Island. And needless to say, on the very early in the morning of the 18th of June, I wondered what in the hell I had done and why I had made this huge mistake, you know, as I experienced my first shit can revenue, so to speak. So I did 4 years enlisted. It was a different Marine Corps back then, lots of opportunity, end of the Vietnam War drawdown. Served as a very young drill instructor for a couple of years, and I was actually the youngest drill instructor in the Marine Corps at the time. I actually graduated my first recruit platoon at the age of 20, so I wasn't legally able to get into the bar for the post-series DI party, but they managed to get me in there anyway. I got out after my 4 years, went to college on the GI Bill, East Stroudsburg State College, back then it was called. It's now a university. They changed it to a university the year after I graduated. I always wondered if there was an association with that, that, you know, they couldn't get the university status when they had a student of my intellect in there. Take 4 years. I was a phys ed major. I actually refer to East Stroudsburg. I used to catch crap for that, too, when I told people in the Marine Corps, where'd you go to college? East Stroudsburg. Who the hell ever heard of East Stroudsburg? I said, come on, man. It's known as the phys ed mecca of the East Coast. You know, we crank out phys ed teachers by the bushelful.
Exactly. The phys ed, the Harvard phys ed of the East Coast. Everybody knows that.
That's what I said. Goldman Sachs of the phys ed realm, you know. Like, proud of it, you know. I mean, you know, when I went to college, I had two wardrobes. It was PT gear, and then there was your dress PT gear, you know, that you went to class with. And other than that, that was as formal as I got, dress PT gear, you know. So I graduated from, I went to OCS during my junior summer, PLC combined, which was interesting because many of the drill instructors, you know, the sergeant instructors and all of that, many of the OCS staff were actually on the drill field with me when I was a drill instructor. So that made for some interesting, you know, random meetups during the trail runs and things like that, where I'd be running, you know, and a guy would be running toward me, and he'd looking at me like, I know this guy, but he's a shaved head recruit. And sure enough, they'd look at the back of my shirt and see my name on it and start laughing and wonder, what are you doing here, you know? So my explanation was, well, you know, based upon my fit reps as a drill instructor, I honestly thought that I wasn't going to be able to become a gunnery sergeant, so I had to become an officer to remain in the Marine Corps, you know, non-promotable to gunnery sergeant, so had to do it.
Nice.
So, you know, the rest is history. I got commissioned in, you know, the summer of 82, June of 82, and remained until I retired in 1998. And along the way, and I was an infantry officer, so I served in, you know, infantry and infantry-related roles, had a great career, had a lot of fun. And then in 1998, being the geopolitical wizard that I was, I declared that, you know, it's 1998, I've done everything I wanted to do. There's certainly no wars on the horizon. Nothing happened. And we've done it all my life. And so I retired, you know, and went to work for a publicly traded staffing company as the director of leadership development, and the dot-com crash hit. The company went through hard times, so that was bad. The good news was there was a lot of opportunity. So these were really good people, Mac. I really landed in a very bad situation, but with great people. And so the opportunity was there for battlefield commissions, so to speak. And so I went from knowing nothing about business to very quickly being put in a position where I had to learn about it and was being mentored and groomed appropriately. And then I very quickly became one of the senior executives in the company, stayed there for 15 years, retired, and then, you know, started Fidelis, which is what I'm doing today. So I've been retired from the company, K-Force, it's called. I've been retired since the fall of 2013, so time is flying. So I've been doing the executive leadership and the coaching and all that for 5 years now, and loving life.
You're also a veteran of both Grenada and Beirut?
Grenada, Beirut, and I have a company, an infantry company, a weapons company in the Gulf War in 1-8.
So you had a pretty exciting, the Marine Corps wasn't doing that much in that period of time, and what it did do, you were a part of a bunch of it. Mike, I want to ask you, General Furness has lit off a pretty interesting discussion, in the Marine Corps and around the Marine Corps. I mean, when I say around the Marine Corps, on the periphery, people that are interested. The first one I want to ask you, question is, well, let me give you an opportunity. General thoughts on, you saw the story, how, and what was your initial thought when you saw this story about the commanding general of the 2nd Marine Division having an issue with discipline and the way the division goes about its business? Your first thoughts when you saw that? How did you see it, and what were your first thoughts?
Yeah, fair enough. I did see it. I didn't get any inside info or heads up on it. Obviously, I know Dave Furness. But I saw it on the web, and the article I saw was not flattering to Dave or this initiative. So I read it, and then read some of the comments below it, you know, from anonymous people and all that. And because I know Dave, knowing that, you know, Dave is, you know, probably one of the most experienced combat leaders that we have in the Marine Corps today, and I also know him to be a very good man and a very fine officer, I know that his intentions are pure, and that if a general officer saw fit to fire this shot across the bow of the 2nd Marine Division's leaders, he did not do that lightly. And so I trust him. I gave him the benefit of the doubt that that this is real, and that he's, you know, this is not the first time he's bringing this up, I assume. I mean, if he's firing that public shot, that's sure to bring literally national attention to the Marine Corps and him and his division, much of which will not be flattering attention. They'll just go to the low road quickly, as I think everybody is seeing. He didn't do that lightly. So Furness is no fool. It's just the opposite, actually. So I'm encouraged, actually. I think that there's probably many people in the Marine Corps, and even more who are no longer in the Marine Corps, that have probably saw this article, given the same benefit of doubt, and are saying collectively, thank God someone finally has stepped up to address this. You know, the 400-pound elephant, so to speak, sitting in the corner of the room. You know, I've heard this from everyone I've talked to, Mac, over the years, that, you know, certain things are eroding and blah, 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 this and that. And, okay, well, who's gonna surface it? Who's gonna try and fix it? So those are my initial thoughts. I think that he's seen problems. He's probably tried to deal with them at the more traditional ways, methods, and levels, and he wasn't seeing the progress. And, you know, when you're the big guy sitting in the big desk up there, it's results, time for results. And so it's a matter of who is or is not capable and willing of fixing this problem. So I think he's got their attention.
All right, let me ask you a question. You came into a Marine Corps, and I want to talk about kind of the institutional ebb and flow of when, you know, the majority of a service deploys and participates in some way, shape, or form in, quote-unquote, combat, and then comes home. I mean, you can read the writings of Eugene Sledge, how they felt after Okinawa when all of a sudden they start having formations. And, you know, they, especially when they come back to the States or they get back to Hawaii or someplace, and somebody who hasn't done what they've done is putting them in formation, is telling them what to do, is on their ass about their uniforms. You know, that meets with scorn from, quote unquote, the old breed.
Yeah.
So there is an ebb and flow with the institution. So you joined a Marine Corps that was very much, being, torn apart or being assaulted, I would say, by racial issues, by discipline issues. Do you think there's an element of what an organization goes through on the backside of combat where you have people that come back from fighting and being involved and they come back and they say, you know, Garrison's bullshit. You know, the only thing that matters is what happens in combat. This is all chicken shit. It doesn't matter. And then they slowly but surely, because how much the Marine Corps turns over, you know, about a third on an annual basis, about 30,000 on an annual basis, I should say. You know, so those people leave. And then you have people that don't have that experience but have that sentiment, right? So they're not colored by the experience, and yet they have the same scorn. And that is there an institutional ebb and flow, do you think? Or does this thing just happen when we're not paying as close attention? Or is it fiction, as some would allege?
No, I think, yes, the answer is yes, with some qualifications.
Okay.
I do think there's a natural ebb and flow. You know, people come back and all of a sudden, you know, changing the batteries and the NVGs and the radios and making sure the weapons are clean and the fire support plan is tight. has become less important now, and all of a sudden someone's getting on my ass, you know, about my boots and brass and haircuts and area police and all of that. You know, I mean, you're always going to have that. The most effective leaders snap units back into shape pretty quickly. So yes, I do think that it played a factor in it. However, I think by this time, knowing that for the most part we're way wound down in Iraq and Afghanistan, not to minimize what's going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, or Syria, or anywhere else Marines are deployed, this is not the 2nd Marine Division where, you know, the vast majority of Marines have already deployed and this and that. It's not that way. In fact, I did talk to Dave Furness fairly recently, and he told me that when he took over the division and spoke to every, you know, audience or several audiences of every staff NCO and officer in the division, he asked for people to raise their hands if they had combat service of any kind. And he said in a packed base theater, in every instance, no more than a dozen hands went up of the several hundred staff NCOs and officers of the division. So the notion of a 2nd Marine Division that is rammed, you know, chock full of steely combat veterans and still got bloodstained camis on and, you know, tidbits of flesh on their K-bars, that's not accurate anymore. I do think that the division, I bet, I don't have the stats, but I'll bet the division is comprised largely of 1st, 2nd, and maybe early 3rd term officers and enlisted, most of whom have no combat service, not their fault. Most of them have very limited deployments or time. And here's the aggravating factor, Mac. When I was a young Marine and young officer, I was told, look, you've got to master being a Marine. And mastering being a Marine means you have to master the garrison aspect. You have to be squared away. You have to do what Marines always do. Because, these were sergeants majors talking to me saying, I was in the Marine Corps in the Pacific for 4 years, career for 2 years, 3 tours in Vietnam. And that means out of the 29 years of total service I have, 5 of them were in combat. And more than 25 were peacetime. So figure it out, Marine. If you do go to combat, chances are it's going to be days, weeks, or months. But you can't, you know, be a slob and a turd thinking that, you know, your limited combat experience is going to carry you through another 15 years of peacetime. The problem is that I think a lot of senior staff NCOs and field grade officers, more of the senior field grade officers, it was just the opposite for them. That statement wasn't valid. If you were commissioned in 2001, if you enlisted in 2002, all you didn't know was combat Marine Corps, you know, in wartime Marine Corps. All you knew was repeated deployments where some of the more garrison-type things took maybe a back seat because, hey, we're redeploying again. We just did Fallujah. We're redeploying again in 10 months, and we're going to Ramadi this time. You know? And so I think a large part of the problem is you have a very large segment of the staff NCO and field grade officer population with very minimal experience of running a peacetime Marine Corps. Therefore, they may be less capable of snapping the force back like the more mature staff NCOs, more professionally seasoned staff NCOs and officers of the past. I'm not demeaning them. If I'm an officer, I'm a lieutenant, and I've got 5 combat deployments, 6 combat deployments, and all of a sudden after 9 years, they throw me back in and I'm a battalion XO. I mean, I may know what the hell I'm doing completely in combat, but I am less equipped to provide the nuts and bolts instruction of, look, hey, here's what a battalion does, captains and lieutenants, in the rear. We really do have to go to CACs. We really do have to prepare for DG's inspection. You really do have to inspect your Marines and get squad leaders involved and all of that. I'm not saying they're incapable of doing it. I'm saying that if I was to give advice to Furness, it was don't assume that most of your senior leaders, your very senior leaders know how to do it. But don't assume that everybody, just because someone's wearing oak leaves or staff sergeant stripes or, you know, bunny stripes or whatever, don't assume that they know how to do this. I think they want to do it, but I think that they probably need a little bit more instruction and supervision from senior staff NCOs and officers to do it. I think in the past that instruction wasn't necessary. I am convinced it is necessary today based upon input and anecdotes that I've heard from my sources around the Marine Corps. They said they've got willing people, but they literally, in some cases, have no experience in what it is to be a company gunny in the rear, because their role models as company gunnies were all literally in deployment mode, combat mode, getting ready for combat. So they were focused, rightfully so, on the necessary thing. So long-winded speech, but I do think the ebb and flow is there, and I do think there are some unique circumstances associated with today's Marine Corps, and obviously 2nd Marine Division as they finesse season.
Interesting. I want to another part of this is much of the comments, many of the comments on social media, you know, you'll see from what I would say look to be one-term Marines. They may have spent that term deployed, and they may have been in Iraq or Afghanistan, and you'll see the statement that, hey, the way you are in garrison has nothing to do with the kind of, you know, fighter you are when you go forward. And I believe there's some truth to that. As an individual, you might be an average performer, but all of a sudden now your head's in the game, right? You are acutely riveted to the task at hand, and you become an above average performer. I want your comment on this. Organizations, though, don't behave like that. Individuals might be able to, but if you're not a very good organization in garrison, if you weren't a very good organization when you went to do ITX, you know, the you know, the version of CACs that we have today, as the saying goes, you don't get fairy dusted on the flight over. You tend to be a poor performer forward, whatever you're doing. So I'd be curious about your comment about it, because so much you see so many comments about, you know, and the phrase is one pump chumps, right? Right. So from people that do one deployment and get out, and it's, but the world that they know, right, is what they know. They've never, they didn't stay in the Marine Corps long enough to see how organizations behave. And I'd just be curious about your thoughts on those two competing viewpoints of what discipline is and what it is not.
I think you're spot on there. I've seen those comments. I've seen some comments on some articles about General Furness and what he's doing there. And the guy will say, you know, Joe Smuccatelli, you know, in the, you know, 3-7 Vietnam, 67, 68. And so those are the guys you're talking about. But these are our brothers. These are Marines. And they deserve an opinion. They're entitled to it. They went out in the bush for 13 months. But that said, that's all they know. They went to boot camp, ITR back then, went to Vietnam, 13 months, managed to live, survive, got back to the States, went to Oakland or Los Angeles, and literally there was out-processing centers in so many airports. At worst, at most, they went back to Pendleton or Lejeune or somewhere else, and they were there for less than 30 days. So they got, a lot of these guys got less than 2 years in the Marine Corps. Hardened combat vets? Absolutely. Exposure to the peacetime Marine Corps and what it takes to maintain a Marine Corps so it can go to war and kick ass, they have literally no experience in it. And so they're, while their opinions are certainly welcome, I would encourage everybody to, you know, maybe put a little asterisk behind it. It's no different when I was a young Marine saying, why can't it? What's so hard about this? Why can't this happen? And then you get promoted. Next thing you know, you're up there and you realize, oh, okay, now I understand. I, you know, I don't have a PFC's perspective anymore or a second lieutenant's perspective. I understand while these older people, senior people want this to happen, you just can't do it with a snap of the fingers. So I do think that most of the flack that will be aimed at this initiative and finesse personally and the division will be aimed at people that don't have a lot of context in general about, you know, the garrison Marine Corps, peacetime Marine Corps. And I don't say that pejoratively. We need to get, you know, if we can't survive in garrison, we can't go to combat. Like I said, there's no fairy dusting. And then I think that people in the Marine Corps who have a longer perspective probably don't, and I certainly don't, I don't have the inside perspective. I don't know what Dave Furness has gone through. I don't know how many iterations he's gone through to cause him to fire that missile across the bow of the division's officers and staff NCOs. I just assume that it's not the first round in the magazine, that he's, you know, basically firing the FPF now. I mean, whatever he's done is not, I assume he's talked to staff NCOs, regimental commanders, all of this, and for whatever reason, it's not filtered down to the squad and fire team level as quick or as effectively as it needs to be. Because it is what it is. If he and other senior people are walking around and seeing Marines that are just not looking, acting, and, you know, being Marines, it is what it is. There's no denying that. And I don't blame him. I blame their small unit leaders. I would blame Furness and other leaders and have no respect for him and other leaders if they looked at it, saw it, and turned their head. And I'm not accusing anybody of doing that, but I suspect some of that has gone on in the past, maybe even the recent past, maybe even now. And based upon what I know, God bless Furness for doing it. He's seeing it. I don't think he's saying that the Marine Corps is terrible. I don't think it's anything close to the Marine Corps I entered in 1974. But I do think that in some instances, the survival of our institution as we know it, I think there's a threat there. I think the lines have been probed and in some cases breached. I think it's time to take a step back and maybe do a stand down and see, you know, what's being a Marine? What does being a Marine mean? What's an NCO do? What's he expected of? You know, Mac, I was a 20-year-old drill instructor, a boot. I was one of the only non-Vietnam vets in my DI class. We had Korean War veterans as instructors. And I was a squared away young Marine. I was a squared away young, my squad instructor in DI school was a gunnery sergeant named Hector Mata. He was a Korean War vet and Vietnam. It's actually Chesty Puller's driver in Korea for a while. his first tour as a drill instructor was in 1956. He said, you know, I've had four tours as a drill instructor. This is 1976. I've had four tours as a drill instructor. First one, 1956. And after he got done talking, I raised my hand. He goes, yeah, what are we on? Before I said, hey, Gunny, your first tour as a drill instructor was the year I was born.
You didn't
and
say
I
that.
Said that. I did. I was just so boot, you know. I wasn't even shaving every day at that point. And the whole class turned around and looked at me and said, you've got to be kidding me, essentially looking at me. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, thanks a lot for saying that. He said, you know, like, oh my gosh. So he, from that point on, it was known he used to refer to me as cash sales. And for cash sales, you know, because I was still smelling like mothballs, you know, from my initial issue. But yeah. And so my point is, I'm not trying to glorify myself young. The bottom line is I'm 20 years old. I'm a drill instructor. I am expected to portray the same kind of leadership and professionalism as those guys that hunkered down in Quezon, as the guys that were in, you know, hey, all the battalion sergeant majors back then were Vietnam and Korea vets. All of the real senior staff NCOs and officers were World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. The commanding general was a guy named Kenny Houghton, who was in the Macon Raid. With the Raider Battalion. So, I mean, these were, you know, they cut no slack. And while I was a boot and I was sporting a national, I didn't even have a good combat medal then. I was sporting a national defense. I took a lot of good natured crap for it. But the bottom line is this, they trusted me. And when it was 1630 or 1700, whatever, and it was time for the other drill instructors to go home, fresh faced Sergeant Etoile was a bone in the squad with 85 recruits. Making sure that they were, you know, getting squared away, taking showers, blah, 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 putting them to bed, doing what I got to do, filling out paperwork. And here's the point. It's not that I was so good or capable. Instead, I was trained, supervised, and expected to toe the line. That was the price to pay to wear that campaign cover. And I refuse to believe that there are not any other, let me put it this way, I believe there are thousands of young 20-year-old e-tours out there right now just waiting to step up and be that kind of powerful, you know, good leader type NCO and staff NCO. First, if they're taught how to do it. Secondly, if they're empowered to do it. And then third, if they're supervised. They have to be, everybody, you know, it's the yes and bounces and all of that.
Right.
So I believe these young guys that kicked ass and flew, I watched them with amazement. There's no difference between these guys in combat than the guys that raised the flag on Iwo Jima. But the difference is, I'm not sure that they're being expected to be at that level. And if I had to limit my comments to one thing, I would tell officers and staff and COs, expect much of yourself and push the power downward. You know, if I was able to talk to Furness and say, Furness, give me a roster. How many field grades you got? How many gunnies and above you got? How many sergeants and corporals you got? Well, you know, the sergeants and corporals are going to outnumber all of those by a factor of like 10 to 1. That's where the focus goes. Because when you can get, you know, Mac, when you can get a divisions where, if you can get half of the divisions, fire team leaders and squad leaders behind this initiative, it'll be a miraculous transformation. That's where the rubber hits the road, the squad leaders. And let me say one, you can tell I'm starting to spit, you know, I'm getting so passionate about this. The big vein in my neck is already popping out, but as an NCO, young staff NCO, I was a staff sergeant before I was 22. I would have been insulted initially. And then after several hours or a day, I would have been infuriated had any officer of any grade, much less a general officer, ever have to pull me aside and counsel me for not doing my job as a squad leader, platoon sergeant, drill instructor, whatever the case may be. Unless, and this is the big, it's underlined, unless such counseling was warranted. And so that's the thing. I think Furness in that letter said, hey, if you were accused of being a Marine, would there be enough evidence to convict you? I use that throughout my entire career. I use that in the business world. Hey, if you were accused of being an executive and a leader, would your people be able to produce evidence to convict you in a court of law? And people laugh at that, but it drives the message home.
Right.
So I would adapt that if I was Furness. Hey, if you were accused of being an effective platoon sergeant, squad leader, company commander, platoon commander, would there actually be enough evidence? And I think, you know, the first thing is people need to do the mirror test. I think they need to look in the mirror. I'm not accusing anybody of being a bad person. But clearly, from the input that I've gotten throughout the Marine Corps, and I think from you too, is I don't think there's a massive transformation need. I'm talking more of a calibration. Now, for some, yeah, it may be a swift kick in the ass, so to speak. But for the others, I just think this is a simple course correction, and I think it's going to be effective. But the rubber hits the road with the staff NCOs. That's my advice to Furness is, I'm sure there's staff NCOs bitching right now about, let's just let us do it. Okay. He's probably done this message because that didn't work out already. If I was a staff, if I was sergeant major of the division and other senior, you know, the staff NCOs that run the joint, I'd be circling wagons right now and saying, hey, we've got officers in staff NCO business. And honestly, I understand why they're there. We need to get together right now, ask them, can you just give us a month and watch what happens? And I think that the senior staff NCOs need to light a fire, starting within the staff NCO ranks, and make things happen. That would be my advice to Furness is jack them up like you did, get everybody's attention, but as always, good Marine leader, delegate to your staff NCOs, company grade officers, because those are the guys that went in combat, Mac, and those are the guys that saved the Marine Corps that I enlisted in. It was not field grade officers. It wasn't the sergeants major. It was staff sergeants and below, and captains and below. Those are the guys that rescued the Marine Corps from drugs, racial problems, discipline problems, all sorts of stuff.
Let me I want you to expand on the notion that there is linkage between the way you are as a unit, the way you operate as a unit, as an organization here in CONUS, and then the way you go forward. And again, you went to Grenada, you guys went on to Beirut, you operated in Desert Storm, and you were pretty successful, Mike. They don't hand that Lethbridge trophy to anybody. They don't make anybody, as a 20-year-old Marine, a drill instructor, to spend the night with recruits, no matter, you know, how far down a step that some may perceive that to be. There's still august responsibilities that go with it. I want your thoughts on the linkage, because, you know, when talking to Dave, and I was there and watched it, and I lived every one of these, 19 of the last 31 Marines that were killed in the Helmand Province were our fault. Yeah, did the enemy do stuff? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, when we pointed to those incidents, you know, we say that that shouldn't have happened. That Marine shouldn't be dead. And we lived that, right? We lived that. And so I'm curious your thoughts on the linkage between the way you exist as an organization in CONUS and then what you are when you go forward.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not going to say anything that you don't agree with. Bottom line up front, disciplined units that are well led in garrison are typically your best units in combat. They're at least, at worst, they're adequate. They'll take their lumps, but they're adequate. They range from outstanding, you know, just mediators, killers, to, you know, they're okay. Units that have discipline problems because of the lack, really, of company grade and staff NCO and NCO leadership of enforcing the basics in garrison, I don't ever see them rising to this. They've been not the experience that they've risen to the occasion, all of a sudden got fairy dusted, and these are your go-to units. You have problems with them in the rear, and their problems in combat. Next thing you know, they've got patrols out, but they haven't called the tang ops, you know, they don't have them on the graphics. They don't know who the hell's up. Next thing you know, you got an intramural firefight. So this was banged into my head by the World War II and Korea and Vietnam guys. You know, yes, each one were, yes, you have to kick ass on haircuts now, on shining boots, on making sure their belts are clean, the brass is shined. Now, teacher, when you go to combat, all of those things, you may ignore those. You're going to be no barber. You're not going to shine your boots. But all of that discipline that the Marines are used to doing and the staff NCOs and NCOs and company and officers are used to enforcing and supervising, all of that now gets transferred and applied to changing the batteries, making sure the LPOPs are set, making sure the passwords, everybody, you know, all the other details that, if ignored or poorly supervised, lead to dead Marines. And I've seen it happen. I've seen people, I'm trying to anonymize some of these things.
Right.
I know of one Marine in Beirut who killed himself. He died as a result of playing with unexploded ordnance. He knew better. He saw something on the ground. It was all over the place. He was taught not to do it. Everybody knew, don't go near those things. And this guy decided he was going to go around and kick this device, this piece of ordnance. And it exploded and killed him outright. I don't think his family knew that. They just knew that it was an accident. He hit a piece of ordnance. But people were there. I wasn't an eyewitness to it, but I talked to the eyewitness. They said, no, he was actually joking around about it, and he kicked it like a football and killed him. Trauma, almost broken in half. I've seen other things like that where a lack of discipline, you know, people doing what they were told not to do, what they know not to do, and their leaders not supervising. They get them killed. I can't tell you how many times, you know, in Beirut, there was a lot of lead in the air, bullets flinging all over, and they weren't necessarily aimed at us. We were just in the neighborhood. It was all over the place. And, you know, after two or three days of calmness, I started noticing, always my Marines, you know, their helmets were off, they didn't have their flaks on, they were standing on rooftops, skylining themselves, and and myself and the platoon sergeant and the NCOs, you know, we would just have to constantly tighten them up because there's no warning. You could hear artillery coming in, but you can't hear the mortar coming.
Right.
And if a mortar hits the top of that roof and you don't have your helmet on or your flak, what little chance you have of surviving is really, you've just pissed it away. And I've seen that happen. I've actually seen that happen. Again, I'm anonymizing the incidents and all that because I don't want this to get back to families. But to answer your question, have I seen Marines maimed and killed because they lacked discipline and or they did not have the benefit of that hard driving, often referred to as just hard ass NCO, staff NCO, and junior officer leadership? Yeah, I have seen it. And everything that I did, if I could be accused of one thing as a leader in the Marine Corps, I can be accused of rightfully being obsessed with discipline in garrison. And I think I was equally obsessed with explaining to these Marines, you can call it chicken shit, and it may be, but this is the kind of stuff that I'm telling you. I mean, a sacred duty, an obligation to prepare you to combat and get your back to your parents. And I can't ensure and instill that level of discipline, nor can my leaders with me. We can't do it once we're in theater. If you've got the discipline that you have when you land in the AO, you're going to learn some lessons, but I guarantee you, if you're an undisciplined unit and a unit that whose leaders have forgotten the S and Bansis and aren't applying it correctly, you are going to learn exponentially greater number of lessons, and I'm talking very, very bloody lessons. You would know better than me, Matt, and Sergeant Furness and the guys that have been in Afghanistan and Iraq and all these times. No one ever talks about it, but if Furness has come up and said that like 19, I think, out of his last 30-some casualties fell in that category of unnecessary, easily avoidable, stupid mistakes, errors, or behavior, Furness, there was nothing magical about his unit. Apply that to almost every unit that cycled in and out of there for 10, 12, 15 years. How many deaths? How many deaths and injuries? How many people walking around with no legs today or blinded and all that are a result of their stupidity, someone else's stupidity, or incompetence? Or worse, leaders who didn't live up to the expectations of their place, their station in life.
You know, I won't go into it, but Mike, I mean, I watched everyone. I was a part of every one of those trying to save their lives after they got, you know, the shit blown out of it. Or in some cases, it wasn't possible; they were dead instantly. But, you know, a blue on blue or no ADRAC is given, and so the gunner lines up on the wrong target, sees somebody, it's Marines, right? No direction, no distance, no direction given, distance of 1,100 meters, I think. And in the investigation, the gunner lines up on somebody that's about 500 meters away, and he yells identified, and the vehicle commander says, if it's enemy fire, the gunner hears fire, shoots, and kills one of his best friends. A local patrol around a firm base in Afghanistan, seatbelt not on, ID goes off, should have had an ankle broken in multiple places, thrown against the steering wheel, aorta ripped out of the heart, dead. Don't take gators off the firm base. ID goes off, one KIA immediately. What happened? A gator rolled over ID on the way to a firm base outside, a squad firm base outside the company firm base. What is the gator doing out there? They had gee dunk and some other stuff they were taking down there. It was too much for them to carry. I mean, and those Marines are dead forever, right? They're dead forever. And there's 19 different versions of those stories that people live with. Now, I don't know as a first term Marine where you live it and you know, you see stuff and you come back with, well, shit happens. And then you view it from the organizational perspective, and you see that as a broader narrative of a unit, as you said, that doesn't execute the sixth step in troop leading, which is supervision, that doesn't pay attention to detail, and you see the price they pay, the butcher bill they pay, as opposed to the butcher bill that a discipline unit, right, that comes into theater, that does it right, that has people doing those things, pays. And it is vastly different. I want to ask you about emasculating staff NCOs and NCOs, right? I think this is an interesting discussion because our culture doesn't do adversity anymore. Our culture doesn't do consequences. You can fail every course that you're taking as a junior at Estancia High School in Costa Mesa, California, where my daughter Colleen goes to school, and you're going to move from the junior class to the senior class, okay? You don't pay for that, right? We don't want to hold you back. So we don't do consequences as a culture. Yet you come into a culture that does expect results, that doesn't particularly care about your feelings. And then this whole idea of what hazing is and what hazing is not, right, exemplified by the hysteria around Marines United. Was Marines United a poor behavior? Absolutely. Was it criminal in certain cases? Absolutely. Okay, but what the effect it has is if I yell at you, if I call you glasses, now I've hazed you, right? And yeah. What does that do to our NCOs and staff NCOs? Now what do? I assign you if you've committed some sort of transgression, I assign you an essay. That's punitive action now in the Marine Corps. I can't yell at you. I can't call you shit for brains, right, because that might hurt your feelings. And to me, like, have we taken, if that's the way staff NCOs, like, if that's the world they live in, what power, the only real power then is the power of non-judicial punishment? Because I can't keep you here arbitrarily. I can't go out you, I tell a story about in the early 80s when I joined the Marine Corps, the staff NCOs were pissed because there was an Almar that said, if you send a guy out back to dig a fighting position, which is going to take the majority of the day, do it by the numbers, have the sump pump, have the sandbags, right? Have everything there, right? And there was an Almar that got put out that said you had to periodically go out and supervise that. And they were pissed.
Yeah.
Like, what? Like, what kind of stupidity is that? And so the Marine Corps has come a long way. Have we emasculated our middle, where the rubber meets the road leadership to the extent where they don't have any power anymore?
Yeah, short answer is yes. To some extent, I think we've done that. So I'm going to ask the question a little bit lengthier. I believe, again, Mac, that I'm a retired Marine. I'm a Marine. I'm going to be a Marine until the last squeeze of my heart. I believe we're in a fight for the very survival of the institution. And I've got friends that are general officers or very senior sergeants, majors, and master guns, and I always tell them, hey, you're it. This current crop of general officers, colonels and senior staff NCOs, these guys have been left holding the bag that contains the results of many what I call death by a thousand cuts decisions by politically correct or just morally cowardly predecessors. And so I'm going to make a bold statement here, and it's going to probably piss some people off. The Marine Corps is no different than any corporation in America in the sense that if you start letting lawyers drive your operating philosophy, you are not going to be an effective warfighting institution because you're going to be more focused on avoiding risk and avoiding congruence and avoiding hurting Johnny's feelings and all of that than you are about achieving the mission, which is producing a combat-ready Marine Corps and ensuring that Johnny, Jimmy, and Mary are actually as prepared as possible to face the horrors of what they may be asked to do someday. A it doesn't work in the Marine Corps, and it also doesn't work in the business world, as a matter of fact. Every company I've ever gone into where they let the attorneys drive, oh, we can't do that, somebody may fall in the warehouse, we can't do this, they end up, at best, minimizing their effectiveness. At worst, they go out of business. And then a new boss comes in, puts the lawyers, who you need, in their rightful place as advisors. Tell me what you advise, and then I'll decide whether I'm going to follow your advice. Tell me when I'm about to break the law, and we're certainly not going to do that. So I do think there's an element to that in there. And here's a testament. I don't know if this is true, Mac, but I know somebody very well-placed in the Marine Corps, very well-placed, that has told me repeatedly. Now, remember, I was a good Marine. You've already said, you know, I was fortunate enough to be in the right spot at the right time. I received some recognition. So I got to believe, and I want to believe that I was at least a good Marine leader. Some would say I'm like you were maybe on a level or two above a good leader. But whatever. I've had this person, highly placed, tell me, Mike, you would not survive today in the Marine Corps as a staff NCO, a lieutenant, or a company commander. You would not survive. I'm like, why? I mean, I wasn't doing anything wrong. So I know that you're not doing anything wrong. But today's climate, Mike, you were just, if you came in and we transplanted you and you continued business as usual, you're just too flat out demanding. You're too demanding that people do their jobs, and were especially demanding of your leaders. Because you had been one, you were deaf on a squad leader or a platoon sergeant or a lieutenant that wasn't doing his level of the esobansis. And in today's Marine Corps life, you would talk to the guy, you would talk to him again, and about the third time you'd start talking and you might be using a little bit more forceful tone in your voice. And the guy realized it's serious. It's almost time for, here, sign this, stick that, and all that. It's almost time. And what he would do in today's Marine Corps is, they'd launch a command climate survey on there. He would call it. He would complain, and I'd be, it's hazing. I'm a gunner. You can't talk to me like that. I'm a lieutenant. You can't talk to me like that. And what he says, Mike, remember now, what you were doing, thousands of other leaders were doing back then. It was just good, effective leadership that scaled up as the severity and tenure of somebody not meeting the mark, you know, progressed and all of that. So you, Mike, I'm telling you right now, you have zero chance of making it today. You would have to offer your, and so I sat back, and I believe him. I don't want to believe in that, but I have to believe him. I'm like, you know, there's something fundamentally wrong when what I know and what you know was considered sound small unit leadership, special trust and confidence, teacher, scholar, all of that stuff. That's not what we're looking for anymore, and much less, not only we're not looking for it, are you telling me that that's not tolerated anymore? If that's the case, then I think Vanessa has opened up a huge can of worms that, quite honestly, I am going to sit back and watch and see how the Marine Corps supports him on this. Are they going to band with him, or the sergeant's major and all that going to band with him and say, you know, don't like that he did it publicly, but we've got a problem, you know? I mean, it was General Lewis Wilson, our new commandant in 1975, that went to Congress and said, look, we're authorized 185,000 Marines. I want to shit can 20,000 of them right now because I'd rather have 165,000 good Marines than 185,000 that has 20,000 shippers. We've got guys with 10 NJPs, two special corps, their UA, their problems, race riots, drugs, and all of that. And we're spending 90% of our time on 10% of our people. Can I shit can them? And Congress trusted them to go for it. We won't take those bodies away from them. We know you've got to do more recruiting and all that. And Lou Wilson came up, and then they created something called the Expeditious Discharge Program Act.
Right, right.
And it came down to me. I was a sergeant. We had a lot of turds. We had a lot of good guys, but we had a lot of turds. And Jim Badalini, who retired as a major general, was my platoon commander. And he came down and said, Sergeant Ecroy, he's got a piece of paper saying this. You're not going to believe it. Today is our lucky day. I'm like, what? He goes, this is the expeditious discharge. Put in effect, it's a message from the commandant of the Marine Corps. Effective immediately, we are, essentially what he says is, you know, the guys that have given us problems that don't want to be here, we don't want them to be here, we're discharging them next week. I'm like, no, you're kidding me. So I was able to go and say, hey, Smuckatelli, come on in here. Come on in, I got news for you. I know you hate the Marine Corps, Green Lady, the suck, and all of that. I know you hate it. And I've got news for you. Today's your day. Here's your checkout sheet. Here's your appointment for your discharge physical. Today's Monday. You're going to be discharged Friday. And the look of shock, well, I'm married. I don't have any money saved, but I'm not ready for it. I'm like, so sorry, Charlie. And we took those guys, ran them through. The great news was they were usually undesirable discharges. And so they didn't even get to keep their sea bag. We were able to march those guys in a truck and bring them to the truck and put them in the main gate. Most people didn't own cars back then.
Right.
And so we were able to make sure they got off the base. I'm not too proud to say that. In some cases, we had to assist them in getting off the base. But the bottom line is, overnight, the Marine Corps breathed a sigh of relief. He doesn't want to be here. He's a bad Marine. Won't listen. Get him out of here. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's needed in today's Marine Corps.
Right.
With one exception. We may have some leaders, Mac. It's a matter of is it a matter of skill or is it a matter of will? I do think we've got some leaders that don't know what to do for the S&Bamps because they haven't been taught and in some cases haven't been empowered to do it. And then I think we have some that do know what we require. They're just not doing it.
Right.
All of that now, I think the solution to everything is junior officer, staff NCO, and NCO. But this is one that falls squarely on senior officers. Only General Neller and the rest of the folks up there, some I know, some I don't, and I'm not bashing them. I applaud them. These are good guys. They've gone way farther than I have as a Marine. But whether or not a sergeant feels that he doesn't have the authority to, in some cases, aggressively count, and Mac, I'm not talking about physical abuse. The staff NCOs that say, let's go back to the old days where I could tune them up behind the barracks. That's bullshit. I saw that in my day. And let me tell you something, that works for a staff sergeant until he runs into the 19-year-old Puerto Rican kid from the Bronx who was a Golden Gloves champ. I've seen that happen. And so the kid goes, skinny 140-pound kid, like, yeah, let's go. Staff sergeant takes him back there. Next thing you know, pit, pat, boom. Staff sergeant is like, he is down for the count. And now we got to go get the corpsman and patch him up, but we don't want to report it because the staff sergeant invited the fight, took the first swing. And wasn't planning on the fact that the guy that he thought he was going to administer hands-on justice to actually knew how to fight. And that was my first appreciation for what a trained boxer could do to an untrained slugger. It was a thing of beauty, Mac. That kid threw about 8 punches. All 8 of them landed in a span of like 7 seconds. And he had mercy. He didn't jump on that staff sergeant and pound him when he was unconscious. But that staff sergeant was out before he hit the ground. And so that's what hands-on discipline gets you. Now, the EPD, the field day, hey, you're going to walk guard around the armory. We just so happen to need someone to walk guard during this 96. You've been not so good as a Marine. You've been a discipline problem. So guess what? You're on the roster. If NCO and staff NCOs and junior officers, they don't have the ability and the authority to do things like that, we might as well end the phone call right now and the Marine Corps might as well just say, let's just transfer our assets to the Army because there's no separator between us and anybody else anymore. And as you can tell, I'm very passionate about it. I'm quick to lay blame where it belongs. This is a staff NCO, NCO and junior officer problem to fix, but they must be given the ammunition by senior officers. And just because it's evolved into this, Mac, doesn't mean it's got to stay that way. That's what, if General Wilson just accepted, hey, it's the Marine Corps, we got dopers, we got race problems, it is what it is. If that was his attitude, we wouldn't even have a Marine Corps right now. So I don't want to hear anything about, you don't understand, Mike, it's too hard. millennials. Let me give you my thought on that.
Hey, hold on. I'll tee that one up for you here in a second, because I've got a question about culture and our popular culture. How much is of our popular culture bleeding into the Marine Corps is a good thing? Because at some point we have to say we can't do what you need us to do if you require us to be like this. Okay, but I want to ask you a question. So I listen to you. Does anybody think this is a problem with the individual Marine?
Yes, I think there's a factor in that. I think that's where I was heading.
Because to me, I mean, Marines are they're canvas, they're clay. They will become what we fashion them to be.
Yeah, I agree with that. When I enlisted in 1974, I came from a generation where all of the parents had lived through the Depression. Most of our teachers, our male teachers, had served in the military. A lot of the gym teachers had been in the military and would kick your ass. I remember I learned dress right, dress, and count off in gym class. That's what my gym teacher had you do. And those were the days where you had white shorts, white t-shirt, white socks, and Chuck Taylor Go-Fasters, and that was the PT uniform for gym. And you will do it. And you will take a shower. You will blah, blah, blah. You will do it. There was no, like, I don't want to dress out, you know? And so, yeah, I do think that I came from a generation. I came from discipline to a discipline. You know, I expected discipline in the Marine Corps. Now, that said, the guys that were in the Marine Corps looked at the ETORs of 1970s and thought they were inheriting hippies and undisciplined people. And they worked with us. Like you said, we were clay. We were a canvas. Because, remember, there was GOAT back then, hippies, peace, anti-war. It wasn't popular back then to go into the military, much less the Marine Corps. So my point is, every generation has looked at the new recruits like, these guys are terrorists. They can't, you know, how can they work with this, you know? And so the new kids coming in, they're not coming from an environment of accountability and discipline and all that. Instead, I think they're running toward it, Mac. I think they're joining the Marine Corps because that kind of tribal discipline, belonging to something bigger than themselves, you know, serving America, being a Marine, dress blues, all of that. I think that's what they're running to. And then I think when they get there, I don't think they're getting what they expect. And then before you know it, I think it's easy for them to just go rogue and start acting like high school or college kids, except they're in the Marine Corps. And this isn't the first generation that's come in and had to have leadership tailored for them. So my point is this. I see millennials come into corporations where there are very strict SOPs, you know, there's machinery, factories, you know, assembly lines, there's investment companies, financial regulations, laws that cannot be violated. And I see millennials come in. Now, they may not be able to pass a PFT, but they come in and they are trained up front. This is our culture. This is our zero tolerance behavior. This function right here, it must be done A, B, C, and D every single time. If you don't, you're going to get fired. I'm going to get fired. The company's going to get fined by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And that's the price to pay to work here. Now, that kid gets training, knows what to do. And you can bet your ass to be effective, the leaders are applying the S advances. Now, I know you're not telling me, Mac, but here's what I'm saying to the Marines that are listening to me. Are you telling me that you can't do with this young generation as Marines? And they can't quit. They're enlisted. They can't just quit. You can't do and mold and shape that clay like a civilian boss who hasn't gone to NCO school. He's not a staff NCO. And you have no leadership training. And more importantly, If he doesn't deliver it well and the guy doesn't like being supervised, that guy can quit that day. He can say, I'm not coming back from lunch. I'm out of here. So it's being done in your best companies. The best companies have small unit leadership. They set the standard. They mold the clay. So this is a case. I'm just asking General Mellor, if you're listening, senior leaders, if you're listening, take a step back and think, because you don't have that experience that I do. Just think, you know, he's right. How does corporate survive? They're getting the same kids we are. How do they get these kids on board and all of that? Now, I have seen companies, Matt. All of these kids are different. You got to have foosball tables for them. You got to do this. You can't do that. And I can tell you, at what I teach is, it's crap. Do not. Here's the money shot back. This is what I tell corporate America, and this is what I'm telling the Marine Corps. Do not ever change your culture for the people you're hiring. They change to meet your culture. Your training methods, it may take you 3 weeks now to train. You know, in the old days, you could just get done in a week because you could just say, hey, here it is. Don't do this. Do this. Got it. Well, you may have to train them differently and teach them differently. But by God, don't change your culture. And I'll leave you one final comment on this. When I enlisted in 1974, outside of the recruiting offices, the Navy said it's an adventure or whatever. The Army said this was a big campaign with the Army. Don't join us. We'll join you. That was their tagline. The Marine Corps came out and said, their poster said, we're not joining anybody. And it said something like, we guarantee long hours, low pay, pain, satisfaction guarantee, something like that. And it had a drill instructor snarling on the poster, pointing, like, get in that door, you know? And that appealed to me. In other words, the Army said, you know, we got to let the hair go. We got to do this. The Navy said, you know, Zumwalt, we got to have beards. We got to let these guys do that. And the Marine Corps said, no, we're not doing that. We got the same problems these guys have. We've got the same recruit pool these guys have, but the bottom line is we have a Marine Corps, and you're going to join it and meet its standards. We are not relaxing our standards. In fact, Lew Wilson's the guy that increased the standards and told recruiters, if you put trash in our Marine Corps and they don't graduate boot camp, it doesn't count against your quota, and you're going to get fired as a recruiter. And he got authorization from Congress that said every recruit had to be a high school graduate. Because not most, but I'd say probably 70% were high school graduates back then. Marine Corps had a lot of high school grads. And as you know, the number one indicator for a recruit meeting his first enlistment is if he graduates high school. If he quits high school, he's already finished the first major, he's already quit on the first major hurdle of his life. So I know I'm all over the page on this, Mac, but hey, Marine Corps, do not change the culture for the recruit. Change the recruit. You may have to change your methods and all of that. Change your recruit. And don't ever change small unit leadership and the authority and empowerment of your junior officers, staff NCOs, and NCOs. If you do that, all is lost. All is lost. I'm not accusing them of doing that.
I am. Let me say it. And again, my perspective is, I mean, I retired in 2015, okay? But I have two sons. One just got out 3 weeks ago. He was a infantry officer in the 1st Marine Division, and I had my oldest son is a captain, just finishing up his tour at the basic school, headed down to Fort Benning to go to school down there, and then back out to the operating forces. So, they'll tell me stories, and they'll both look at me and say, Dad, it's not your Marine Corps anymore. It's different. And my youngest son in particular. And so I would ask them, like, I don't understand how it can function like that. If the only thing you can do as a corporal is to assign an essay, like, you have as much power as a second grade teacher, except the second grade teacher can send somebody to detention and you can't, because to do EPD, it takes an act of Congress, for God's sakes. Right? And you gotta stay there and supervise the whole thing. You know, and there is no fuck anymore. That's now hazing. And I think the Marine Corps has to take a step back and say, look, we have emasculated our NCOs. There's got to be tools short of, you know, the formal written process of EMI, but there is no, the sandbox doesn't exist anymore. Fuck doesn't exist anymore. And that is simply, I'm going to waste your time to get it through your thick head that this is not the way this goes, right? And if you want to do this, we can do this. But I don't need anybody's permission, right? This isn't hazing you. This is me supervising you to get you to understand that you can't win in this game. All right, that you need to bend to the will of the greater organization, and you're not going to be an individual in this thing. Now, when you've taken all that away, so what do? I talk to you nice and I say, please? Is that where we go with this? And so it is our popular culture bleeding into the Marine Corps, and our popular culture revolves around, how does this make you feel, Mike? How do you feel about this? And the absence of consequences, the absence of doing adversity, right? That is our popular culture today. And I know, because when young Marines I talk to about trauma, Mike, they eat it up. Like, what do you mean you're not getting over it? That's the truth. Where did I hear that? Yeah. My gunny told me, after a helicopter incident happened in 29 Palms, where the pilot was decapitated, right? The co-pilot crushed to death. We're trying to save two Marines. Everybody dies inside of the 360 that is my company assembly area as Alpha Company 3rd Light Armored Infantry Battalion in September of 1993. And my gunny looks at me and I said, where did you get that? And he said, Vietnam guys told me that. And so if that's not the way it works anymore, I don't know what tools do they have other than saying please and whatnot. And so that's why I think this is a huge issue that the Marine Corps needs to talk about it. And for whatever reason, General Furness has lit it off in what he thought he was doing inside his division that has now become a broader issue. And I will say it'll become a bigger issue. It'll become a national issue because the Marine Corps does need to have this discussion. How much like our society, of our society, can we absorb, you know, before we can't close with the Chinese and destroy them because we simply aren't good enough anymore because we're so worried about everybody's feeling. And again, I know what hazing is, okay? I've seen it. I've been a part of it, okay? And it's not getting up somebody's ass and calling them shit for brains. That happens on every construction site, right? It happens on sport, on athletic fields across the nation. Hell, if you were just watching the NCAA tournament, it happened multiple times live on national TV, okay? Yeah. The Marine Corps cannot back away from that stuff. But I will tell you this, you know, a PFC coming in and saying, Sergeant Etor's, you know, hazing me to the first sergeant is a shot right across your bow. And if that first sergeant doesn't say, get your ass out of here, right, I want to request mess. Go ahead. You want to go see the sergeant major right now? Let's go. Write it down and we're going. What? And I would tell you, in too many cases, that doesn't happen. And to quote my younger son, the inmates run the asylum in some units. That's not good.
No, it's not. I'm sorry to hear that, and I agree with your sentiments. I do want to take the liberty, Mac, if you'll allow me right now. I do want to say something to General Neller, and I hope he listens to this. General Neller was in the same Marine Corps that I was in 1974. I actually met him when I was a drill instructor. He won't remember me. I was leaving the depot to go to college. And he was a second lieutenant, maybe a brand new first lieutenant that reported to the depot. And back then, we were both big corn-fed guys. We were both Clydesdales, you know.
Right.
And he would be in the weight room at MCRD at about the same time I did. And one of my lieutenants introduced me to him. And I used to spot him, maybe for three workups. I used to spot him on the bench, and he used to spot me. He could lift more than me, by the way, back then. He was strong.
Yeah, he was.
And what are you doing, Sergeant? Well, I'm going to college and all that. Oh, you're going to love it. You're going to come back in as an officer. I said, well, I don't know, sir. I think so and all of that, you know. But here's the deal. Lieutenant Neller knows how it feels. He hasn't forgotten. General Neller, you remember how it feels to be that lieutenant in Okinawa in 73 and 74 and all the older guys telling you, oh, it's a leadership problem. I'm like, no, sir, you don't understand. I got Marines smoking dope. I got Marines beating each other to death in the barracks. I got this. I got that. You didn't deal with that in the 30s and 40s. It's not just a leadership problem. You got to help me out. And they did not, in some regards. They said, oh, no, they got no problem. But, you know, we're just living off of our history, you know. And General Neller and others, his peers, they were the company grade officers. And staff NCOs and NCOs that were trying to stem the tide. And in many cases, they weren't being equipped from above. And then Lew Wilson came in and equipped them. and change things. Because everything you just described, Mac, oh, you can't yell at me again, that was what Marines were saying in 1973, 4, 5, 6. You can't talk to me like the same exact protestations, except the gunny would be like, wait a minute, what are you in here for? Get your ass out of here. Like, get out of here. Go talk to your sergeant. They'll never come and be complaining again because he tuned you up and made you do an extra fire watch because your rifle's dirty. You're exactly right. That's the first line of defense is, the first line of defense in situations like that is the first leader above me in my chain of command. He's got to have my back. So, General Mallory, you remember what it feels like. And I think what your Marine Corps is telling you, General Mallor, your company grades, staff NCOs, NCOs, in some degrees, they're telling you that they feel as unempowered and unequipped and as abandoned by some of their senior leadership as you did and your peers did and I did in the early to mid-70s. I'm not saying that it's intentional unequipping and unempowering. I'm just saying, can you and your leaders just step back? Take a step out of the firefight, look at it, and see if there's any merit to it. Because you, General Miller, and you older people, you know how helpless that feeling was. I was there. I remember there was no budgets. I stood outside a chow hall one time waiting to get in, and all of a sudden those heavy porcelain coffee cups came shooting through the windows from the inside. There was a race riot inside. I remember that each Camp Horno had a REACT squad, a REACT. General Miller will remember this. They used to go around to the rifle companies and get the biggest, baddest dudes. To recruit officers and staff and COs, I'm talking about like the guys that look like D1 football players, and they would assign them as the REACT force. And the OD would routinely call those guys out to quell riots and disturbances in the chow hall or in the barracks. And they would just go in and start kicking ass. Now, I don't think we're there yet. We certainly don't want to get there, but we can get there. My first duty in the Marine Corps, Matt, out of boot camp, it was a transient barracks, and some staff on SEAL grabbed me and said, hey, come here. You've got the duty tonight. You're going to help the OD and the staff duty. I'm like, oh yes, sir. You know, I was still calling the gunny like, sir. And so long story made short, in the months leading up to that, evidently a couple of officers of the day had gotten jumped, mugged, beaten mercilessly, and their pistols were taken, stolen from them. And so they started equipping officers of the day and staff duties with bodyguards. So I got pulled into the office, get a duty belt on, get squared away, and they handed, I'm not kidding you, they handed me a pick handle. Without the metal part on it, they handed me a pick handle with a leather thong through the end of it. There was a hole drilled in it. They said, this is your weapon. You just sit right here and you go get coffee from the OD or whatever they tell you to do. But when he goes out for his tour, he's probably going to say, Marine, come with me. You go with him, and your job, Marine, is to make sure that nobody attacks successfully that officer. And God help you, if he gets beat up and his weapon is taken, you better be laying there dead. Because if you're not, I'm going to come and beat you to death with that pick handle. That's how serious it was back then. And General Mallor remembers those days. We're not there yet, but we can get there. And I'm begging the senior leadership to take a step back. Don't be too proud to admit, you know, maybe everything's not rosy. This is what tubes companies in the business world. This is what I do. What I just said, Mac, this is what executives pay me a lot of money for. Because they usually can only listen to somebody from the outside. I usually have to find a way to get them to say, is there a chance that there's problems here? Is there a chance that because of your turnover rate, because people can quit? You know, half of your executives turn over every year. Is there a chance that you're a part of the problem? Is there a chance that it's not the same healthy environment that you grew up in 15 years ago? Is there a possibility? So I'm just asking senior leaders to make, and I'm not excluding the staff NCOs from this. I'm including the staff NCOs. We don't have E-9s. We don't have O-6s. We don't have E-5s. We have sergeants major, master gunnies, first sergeants, lieutenants. We do not have O-5s and all of that. That's where part of the problem is. And then my last comment on this is this, Matt. I have seen on social media, how in the hell have we gotten to the point? I have seen on social media, and when I was up in the June for the Beirut Memorial last fall, I literally have seen staff NCOs and officers out in town on the weekends unshaven. What do you think about that? And I talked to a guy about it. And think, I'm a retired Marine. I was talking to a guy in a store, and I said, yeah, active duty Marine. I said, I asked, I said, do Marines still have to shave, like, you know, 24-7 when you've gotten tired? Oh, no, sir, it's we don't do it anymore. You know, on the weekends, it's okay. And I'm thinking, this is a gunny. This is somebody's company gunny. And he's out here, and this guy had, he could grow a beard. I mean, this guy had 2 days of growth, and it was like Yasser Arafat, you know? and you know, my wife, I used to tell my wife was from another country, she said, could you go to store and pick it up? I said, no, it's Sunday night, and I deliberately stayed home all weekend because my face has a rash on it, and I didn't shave, and there's no friggin' way I'm going to the Piggly Wiggly with 2 days of growth on me, because sure as shit, I will run into one of my Marines out there, and they'll say, well, Trump's not following, you know, he's not being a Marine officer and all of that, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, us old guys, we see little indicators like that, and, you know, Mac, you know, I don't know if you know this, I was grossly overweight as a high school student. I had to lose like 85 pounds to go to boot camp. I'm what I call calorically challenged. I had to be on a diet my entire time in the Marine Corps, or I'd grow out of my uniforms quickly if I didn't have discipline and eat and all of that. But that was the price I paid. You know, that's the price I paid to be a Marine. I still work. I mean, I had to do it. I was nothing special. There were other guys doing the same way. And so my point is, I didn't ask the Marine Corps to change their standards for me. I met the standards. And I would just ask that some of the senior Marines take a step back and say, geez, are we really, first of all, are we empowering our junior leaders to really be the kind of junior leaders that we wanted to be, we were able to be? And then secondly, after we empower them, are we demanding that they do it? And I think that'll go a long way to fix the problem. And I don't claim that to have all the answers. I'm retired 20 years now, but I think if anything comes through with me talking to you here, it's that I love the Marine Corps. I am a Marine. I'm going to get buried in camis. I'm not buying a suit for that. I got a set of camis. That's what I'm getting buried in. I'm going to get, I always thought I would die wearing a set of camis, and that didn't happen. So when I go, I'm going to be buried in a set of camis. I love the Marine Corps. Every success that I've had since the Marine Corps wouldn't have been possible without having been a PFC, Corporal Sergeant, and good officers like Battaglini and Gunny Carter and all those guys just teaching me and mentoring me and, more importantly, empowering me and expecting me to live up to the standards. So I want to tell you that I did tell Furness this. Dave, you got to show people what you're talking about. And if I was talking to the staff NCOs of the division and all that, I'd have a slide presentation or a PowerPoint presentation, and I would say, look, here's what I'm talking about. When I think of the term Marine Sergeant, boom, here's a picture of Sergeant Mike Strank, the squad leader of the guys that raised the flag on Iwo Jima.
Right.
When I talk about staff NCOs, Gunnery Sergeant, boom, this is Gunny Fred Stopham, a company gunny in Bella Wood, who willingly gave his gas mask to one of his Marines who didn't have one during a mustard gas attack. And Gunny Stockham was died because of that, received the Medal of Honor posthumously 20 years later. I'm thinking about Gunny Canley, who for 3 days without an officer ran his company in Ray City. And check this out. Until 2nd Lieutenant Ray Smith, my battalion commander in Beirut, Grenada, until 2nd Lieutenant Ray Smith could arrive, take over the company from the company gunny, even though Smith will tell you, really, Canley was still kind of running the show, even though I was there. 2nd Lieutenant now in charge of a company in Ray City, some of the bitterest fighting in the war. And then, personally, I talk about when a sergeant's there, I would put up a picture of Manny Cox, Sergeant Manny Cox, who was a squad leader in Golf 2-8. And I listened to him. I was up in West Beirut, and the communications were bad, but somebody told me, hey, there's a big fight going on at the airport. And Cox was with about 9 or 10 of his Marines in an outpost about 500 meters forward of the front lines. And they were bracketed by mortars. There's rounds going all over them. And someone made an audio tape of Cox running the show. And I heard it one time. He was running the show. He's calling for fire. He's talking to Captain Dobson, the company. He's running the show. And if I had that tape, I'd play it for all NCOs and staff NCOs and junior officers in the Marine Corps because, hey, here's what you got to do. This is what I did. And as luck would have it that night, Cox was up there kicking ass with his guys, and the last mortar round of the night hit that post and killed them all, disfigured them all. And a lieutenant and a PS and a lance corporal had to crawl that 500 yards, go make sure, yeah, they're dead, and come back. And under captain said, I hate to tell you this, Lieutenant, I hate to ask you this, did you remember to get the crypto gear? And they didn't. They had to crawl back, and they were getting the canteen shot off of their back as they were crawling. When I hear of lieutenants and sergeants and lance corporals, that's what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about Captain Doug Zembeck, who I never met. You heard him, the Lion of Fallujah.
Right.
I know guys that knew him and said, Mike, listen to me, this guy was so good, you would have volunteered to be reactivated to be an ammo humper for this guy's company. This guy was that good. This was an institutional loss when this guy went. This was a future general officer, blah, blah, blah. So I'm thinking about, when I talk about lieutenants and captains, I'm thinking about him. And then last but not least, I'm thinking about Captain Bill Barber, who received the Medal of Honor for his actions on Fox Hill with Fox 27 in Korea, the Chosin Reservoir. My next-door neighbor, Kenny Benson, who I've talked about before, he was one of his Marines in the same fighting hole as Hector Caffaretta, who received the Medal of Honor after that battle. And Benson told me that we were all wounded, we all thought we were going to die, and to be honest with you, some of us wished we would die just to, you know, stop being cold and just, it was miserable. And then I looked up and we saw Captain Barber, who couldn't see out of one eye, he couldn't walk, couldn't move his hands, but he had Marines taking him around on a stretcher, so he could say, hey, we've got machine gun 15 meters to the left. He was leading in a stretcher. And he said, when we saw that, we said, you know, if he can still hang on, we can too. And Benson told me two things. He said, Mike, if it wasn't for Captain Barber leading by example like that, I'm not sure we would have gotten off that hill alive. And then the second thing was, he crudely said, but because he led, I got to tell you, we not only got off alive, we left a shit pot of dead Chinamen on that hill. That's what he said. That's a direct quote. I know it's not politically correct today, but that's a direct quote. And he said he used to go as a reservist. He used to go down to Camp Lejeune every year, and he'd find Barber, and he'd go in. Barber had the 8th Marines, and he'd go in and say, hey, I'm Benny Benson. I was with Captain Barber on Fox Hill. If he's not busy, and he said that the XO would go in the office and say, sir, you got a gunnery sergeant Benjamin, and Barber would run out of the office, and there'd be Marines out there, admin, you know, clerks and all that. And here was a colonel run out, and he'd see Gunny Benjamin, and he would run and pick him up and hug him. And they would get choked up. In other words, this guy was with me, you know, but the respect between them. And so I get emotional just talking about it. When I talk, if I could talk to divisions, NCOs, and staff NCOs, I'd show them pictures of these guys and say, look, these guys were nobodies at one point, just like some of you are. But when the flag goes up, every one of you is going to be expected to live up to that standard. And me personally, I spent over 2 decades trying to live up to the standard of these guys, and I hope to some respect I have. But that's what I would say. I know it's kind of long-winded, Matt, but I love the Marine Corps. I'll do anything I can to help them. I'm certainly not sniping at the chain of command. But I am employing them as a Marine and as a guy who helps institutions out here right themselves in some respects, take a step outside the firefight, look in the mirror, look at what you're seeing, just look at it, look at your fire plan sketch, look at your range card, and look for the dead space. And as you know, dead space will kill you.
Mike, And again, a thought for the senior leaders in the Marine Corps is that you've got to create a climate where you haven't emasculated everybody. That we don't have to apologize for things that construction foremen do, that college basketball coaches do, we know what hazing is, right? And the stuff that people are going to be accused of, we've got to stand together. And be grown-ups, because there's important you know, things at stake here, and that is our culture.
Right.
And our culture is not a, let's say, please culture. And again, nobody's talking about being unprofessional. But if I can't stick my foot up Lance Corporal Etor's ass because he's not out of his rack on time, he's late, his room's messy, he shows up to formation with half the shit he's supposed to, if I can't air his ass out, then, you know, then something's wrong somewhere. Because let me tell you, there's a whole lot worse consequences waiting for you, right? Waiting for you. And Mike and I have talked about just a few of them in our own limited experiences. If you're not disciplined and not disciplined organization. So to me, senior officers and senior enlisted have a huge part in this. You've got to make sure that chicken shit gets crushed. And then leaders know that, hey, you can lead, all right? And leadership requires a little bit of adrenaline every once in a while. We'd like to think it's just, okay, everybody show up and we're going to, it doesn't work like that. Most of the time it goes because people shove it through. And so we've got to make sure that we're not losing that. So any final thoughts on that before I let you go? You've been very generous with your time.
No, you're absolutely right. I agree with everything. I'll give you one last anecdote. When I was in Beirut, Matt, I was alone with 104 Marines up in West Beirut. Everybody else was at the airport, the rest of the MEW, we called it a MAU back then. I actually had more Marines on my own as a second lieutenant than my company commander had at the airport. I used to taunt him about that occasion. I used to not gonna lie, you know. But then Reagan pulled everybody off the coast and off the shore and put them off on ships. And this issue went all the way to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The decision was made by Ray Smith and supported by the chain of command that, hey, this second lieutenant's been up there already for 3 months on his own. Nobody has said anything yet. And just because we're all on the ships right now, we're not moving in with him. He's there. So they left a second lieutenant with a great platoon sergeant named Mike Marshall, and a staff sergeant named Alan Chase, who was the Amtrak debt commander, and we were the officer and staff NCO present in Beirut, Lebanon, while many people senior to us were, you know, 20 miles over the horizon on the ships. I got to add, and you know what? In my battalion, we had Phil Smith. We had Matt Elwood, Gunny Garamo, Sergeant Mike. In other words, there was all sorts of talent on that ship that could have been the same as me. They could have. I just was the lucky guy that got, you know, tagged for that, my platoon sergeant and all of that. My question to the senior leadership was today is, would something like that even be possible today? In a contingency like that, would the lieutenants and staff sergeants, would they be prepared to handle that assignment? And would you be willing to fight to let them handle it? I don't know the answer for that, but I think it's worthy of reflection. There ain't, you know, somebody said in front of Chesty Puller one time, well, he's only a sergeant, and Chesty jacked him up and said, let me tell you, he was talking to somebody in the Army, said, let me tell you something. There ain't no such thing as only a Marine sergeant. And I'll leave you with that. There ain't no such thing, Mac, as only a corporal or only a gunner or only a lieutenant. There ain't nothing that a company grade officer, a staff NCO, or an NCO in the Marine Corps can't do if they're provided with the tools, the authority, and the support to do it.
All right, final. I've got an email question for you, Mac. Really interesting to hear this very fundamental talk about culture, both inside and outside the Marine Corps. I have a very, very basic crystal ball question that I'd like to hear each of you answer. Do you believe that other senior officers and staff non-commissioned officers will take the opportunity to weigh in on this, or do you think they will stand there with their hands in their pockets and gaze at the floor? Mike, what do you think? You think this will be, because again, I do believe it's a discussion that needs to happen. The question is, do you believe it will happen?
Yes. Here's what I would do. I think it's a great question.
No, not what you would do. What do you believe will happen?
I believe that a good number of senior leaders are going to sit on their hands. And they're going to wait and see how the winds blow for Furness. I believe that an unfortunately large number of them are going to, they believe that they would agree with what Furness is doing. They see the same problem, but I believe that an unfortunately large number of them, I'm going to use this as a strong word, are too gutless to stand up, raise their hand and say, he's right, and I should have said this last week before him, but I'm saying it now, I'm with him. I think there's some going to do that, but I think there's unfortunately some that are not. And if I knew who those guys were, I'd put them on my list of ex-Marines, like Lee Harvey Oswald and other people like that. It's a great question. And as far as technique, if I was General Neller, I'd get every one of my senior officers in an auditorium right now, and much like Congress, hey, here's the deal. Here's the issue. This is what Furness is saying. Is he right or wrong? And make them vote. Put them up. Where are you at on this? Now, there may be some that say, no, I just don't agree with Dave. I don't think it's there. I'm okay with that. I don't agree with it, but I think it's okay if a person genuinely doesn't think the problem's there. It's the person that knows the problem's there, but is too gutless to do anything about it, too gutless to raise his hand and say, I'm with him. And I don't know how many of them there, but you know what? If there's one general officer, colonel, sergeant major, that's too afraid, too self-serving, too protective of his career to join in and call a spade, I have no respect for that person whatsoever, and I certainly don't want my son in that unit because he won't be led well.
Well, I'll echo what Mike said. I think that one of the great problems inside the DOD is the amount of conformity on the part of general officers. Too few of them speak their mind. They think it, but they don't speak it. I will tell you this. My own opinion is that Dave Furness will be left alone on this issue, and nobody will say a word. And I think it's terrible because they know that this is an issue that needs to be discussed in the Marine Corps. And no matter, as Mike said, no matter where you are on the spectrum, we need to sit down and have a knockdown drag out about this stuff. Okay?
Yeah.
But my prediction is almost nobody will say, will have a comment to make about him. You will hear no comment, no comment, no comment, if and when they're asked. So, and I think that, and again, you want to know where the true problem lies? I think there you have it. If discipline is too scary of a subject for us to have a frank discussion, then God help the Marine Corps. So, on that note, yeah. Mike, first of all, always love talking leadership with you. Tell everybody where they can, if they're interested in hearing more, where do they find you professionally now?
Well, I write quite a bit on LinkedIn. I post a couple times a week. My website is fidelisleadership.com. I'm actually writing a book called Trust-Based Leadership, Marine Corps Leadership Concepts for Business Leaders. And that's why so much of this stuff that I'm writing about, I'm telling civilians, hey, this is what Marines do. And we just talked for almost 2 hours about maybe not all Marines are doing this stuff. So it's fresh in my mind. I love talking to people. My email address is Mike@FidelisLeadership.com. I hear from somebody every time I talk on your show, Max. Somebody contacts me that remembers me from the past. And, you know, sometimes they say obscene things to me. Other times they say nice things. But I welcome all inquiries. But thank you so much for this. It's always a pleasure. I'm going to go back home now in my own gym and work out. I got all this adrenaline in me. I'm ready to go bust a move, you know.
All right. Mike, thank you for taking time out of your day. Appreciate it. As you know, talking about leadership, talking about the Marine Corps, talking about the sixth step in troop leading is, I think, one of the things that there's some among us are friends for certain reasons. We love Marines. We love being Marines. We love leading Marines and the privilege that was and aren't rightly over it yet. And so continue to watch with great interest, and thank you for coming on and spending the last 90 minutes with us.
My privilege, Mac. Thank you so much, and Semper Fi, my friend.
There you have it. The one and only, Mike Etor. He was, you can look him up, he was a Leftwich Award recipient. He's a leader. He and I crossed paths late in my career, And he's become a great friend and a great counselor. You want to talk leadership, put him near the top of your list because he's done it. And in a variety of different capacities. And so I appreciate his time this morning. Interesting discussion. More of All Marine Radio. We're going to transition a little bit, and we're a little bit late doing it. But we're going to talk. You're going to hear in his own words from a Marine. His name is Josh Gilkey. He's a corporal. And Josh wrote me a letter a couple weeks ago, an email, and talked about how much post-traumatic winning had impacted his life. So in a little bit of bonus coverage, on top of bonus coverage today, you'll hear from Josh Gilkey. And you'll hear about his life. You'll hear about what rocked his life and now how he's changed his view on life to turn around and impact other people. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.